Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about sleep and America's increased use of sleeping medications. You can join the conversation. What's keeping you up late at night? Do you wake up rested? Do you take sleeping pills? Melanie Wells is senior editor at Forbes magazine. Her recent article, The Sleep Racket, Making Big Bucks Off Your Insomnia, appears in the February 27th issue of Forbes magazine. Hello, Melanie. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Your story paints a picture of just how big the sleeping pill industry is. Give us a sense of what you found out.
It's enormous. Clearly, there is opportunity in our suffering. We estimate that sales of everything from prescription pills to bedding and mattresses exceeds $12 billion a year.
So that $12 billion, that's not just pills. That's all of the ways folks are cashing in on people's need to sleep.
That's a lot of the ways. Mm-hmm. That includes pills, mattresses, bedding, pillows, and that's only the beginning.
Wow. What do you mean that's only the beginning? Where does it go?
Well, there are lots of, look, people with sleep problems are an easy target. So there are lots of gadgets and gizmos, things you haven't heard of unless you're one of the desperate sleep-deprived out there, that are supposed to help you get to sleep. You know, speakers, music, weird stuff, fun
what's
stuff.
What's the weirdest, sort of the strangest example that you came across in your reporting?
Oh, my goodness. let's see. Well, an interesting one was it's actually an alarm. It's a watch you can wear, a watch-like device you can wear, and it supposedly can track your stages of sleep and then wake you at a time when you're supposedly in a light stage of sleep so that you will be less groggy and be better rested.
Hmm.
The entrepreneur thinks that part of our problem is that we're, you know, waking ourselves up at a bad time.
Interesting. I want to focus, though, on the pills, because we're all aware of this. Even if we're not taking the pills, we're certainly seeing these advertisements.
Sure.
Just about, you know, they seem to come almost every hour on the hour, or more than once every hour on the hour. To talk about that, what kind of advertising muscle is behind this effort to get Americans to take sleeping pills?
Oh, very big dollars. Cipricor, which introduced Lunesta last year, spent almost $200 million in advertising last year, and they introduced the drug in spring. Sales for Lunesta totaled $329 million through December. So they spent, you know, almost as much as they made promoting this drug. And you know, to your point, who has not seen the ads with a Luna Moss? Ambien, the maker of Ambien's, Sanofi Aventis, is also spending a lot of money. I mean, this is, you know, the sleeping pill ad war is what the erectile dysfunction ad war was a couple of years ago. This is the latest battleground, and there are big dollars at stake. I mean, increasingly people are going to be asking their doctors for help with sleep.
Now, were you able to get at this question in the heart of your reporting, and that is, you know, is this responding to a medical need, or is it creating a demand?
Well, both. You know, sleep experts say insomnia is an epidemic, and I believe it's the NIH which estimates there are 70 million Americans who have sleeping problems. Now, those are everything from sort of garden variety, you know, wake up at 4 in the morning once a month, to really serious sleep disorders, and apparently there are something like 80 sleep disorders like sleep apnea. So there's no question that there are people who have been suffering silently because doctors have not wanted to prescribe sleeping pills, because until very recently, actually with Lunesta, which was approved for long-term use, doctors are very nervous about these drugs being habit-forming and causing people to be groggy the next day. People do have different reactions to these drugs. So there's little question that there are a number of people who have not been treated, who are candidates for treatment. But at the same time, you know, I think what's the danger here is that we're creating a lifestyle drug. And people in 5 years, you know, just as they say, well, I take, you know, Tylenol or Motrin for pain, maybe, you know, we may be saying commonly saying what we take to sleep. Mm-hmm. If this many people truly do have a sleep problem,
I guess this might be an indication of the epidemic of insomnia. It might be an indication of how hectic and demanding our society is.
Well, look, yes, there's little question that we all feel pressured to do more in less time, and we live in a society where heroes are made of people who can boast of getting by on very little sleep, like the CEO of General Electric, for one, who has said he sleeps less than 5 hours a night, which the doctors will tell you is not enough for most people. But at the same time, we're learning that insomnia is perhaps linked to some very serious problems like obesity and cardiovascular problems. So if we're not already stressed and pressured, too pressured to sleep and too stressed to sleep, well, when you think about some of the health problems that supposedly go along with lack of sleep, it's enough to keep you awake at night.
Melanie Wells, thanks for joining us very much. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Anthony.
Sure. Melanie Wells is a senior editor at Forbes magazine. Her recent article, The Sleep Racket, Making Big Bucks Off Your Insomnia, appears in the February 27th issue of Forbes magazine. And we're joined now from San Diego by Dr. Greg Jacobs. He's assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and an insomnia specialist at the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Massachusetts Medical School in Worcester, Massachusetts. He's also author of Say Goodnight to Insomnia, the 6-week drug-free program developed at the Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Jacobs, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Anthony, and thanks for having me on.
Sure, it's great to hear you. And, you know, I understand that you're somewhat of a sleeping pill skeptic, and I'd love to just get your response to this, to what Melanie was just talking about, what Melanie Wells was just talking about, this epidemic of insomnia and the rising use of sleeping pills. What's your take on this?
Well, I think Melanie Wells made many excellent points, and I actually agree with her on all points except one. Insomnia has not been associated with obesity and cardiovascular disease. Sleep deprivation has been, but insomnia patients actually are not equivalent to patients who are individuals who experience sleep deprivation. So there's very little evidence that insomnia is associated with obesity. Sleep apnea is, but not insomnia. Her points about the number of people who have not been treated to date for insomnia are very good. There's a large epidemic of silent sufferers. The sleeping pill manufacturers have capitalized on that by creating and marketing new pills. I agree with her that although some people are now going to receive more effective and safer treatment for their insomnia, the vast majority of patients, in fact, are not going to need sleeping pills long term. What the sleeping pill companies do not tell you are three very important points.
Okay.
First of all, the vast majority of patients who have insomnia do not need a sleeping pill. We know that there is a non-drug therapy that is actually more effective, safer, and less expensive. It's called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT for short. Mm-hmm. And my colleagues and I have now made that widely available on the internet at cbtforinsomnia.com, where you can register and learn interactive cognitive behavioral therapy. And we know from preliminary research on this online interactive program, it's more effective than sleeping pills, and that's consistent with recent and previous research on CBT delivered by therapists.
Okay, Dr. Secondly, wait, I just want to before you list off these points, I want to just sort of stop you and talk about these as you go. I want to get into the CBT therapy that you're talking about, but first, you said they don't need sleeping pills in many cases. Are you saying that they don't work, that they're dangerous, that they're overprescribed, or just that CBT is preferable?
Two reasons, Anthony. First of all, most people who have insomnia do not have severe persistent insomnia. There are a lot of people who are taking sleeping pills, as Melanie Wells pointed out, who have problems sleeping a couple nights a month or a couple nights a week. Getting into using a sleeping pill when you have mild to moderate insomnia is not a good choice, because in many cases, the sleeping pills end up causing more problems than the mild to moderate insomnia.
Really? Such as?
Yeah. Well, there are multiple side effects associated with sleeping pills, even the newer Z pills, as they are now terming them. All sleeping pills cause amnesia during the night. I see patients full-time who have insomnia, and it is routine for patients to say, I woke up in the middle of the night, I went out downstairs, and I had a conversation with my high school daughter, someone that came home from, you know, on a Friday night at midnight, went back to bed, got up in the morning, and the daughter or son recalled the conversation, and the patient never remembered having the conversation. This is well known. Secondly, all the drugs, including the new drugs, cause impairment in next day intellectual and cognitive performance, even Lunesta, even Ambien. And that impairment in intellectual and cognitive performance can be worse than mild to moderate insomnia. Wow.
The pharmaceutical companies are engaged in a heavy advertising blitz of their sleeping aid. Here's a sample of a few recent commercials for Ambien and Lunesta.
A funny thing happens when your body doesn't sleep at night. Your mind zones out during the day. To help you sleep, there's Ambien, the number one prescribed sleep aid in America. There's never been a better time to talk with your doctor about Ambien, because now you can try Ambien free. Millions of Americans who once had trouble turning off their restless minds are catching a great night's sleep with Lunesta. Lunesta can give you and your restless mind the sleep you need. Lunesta helps most people sleep all through the night and works quickly, so take it right before bed.
We're also joined now from Pittsburgh by Daniel Bicey. He's the Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. He's also the Medical Director of the Sleep Evaluation Center at the University of Pittsburgh and the past President of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. And Dr. Bicey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. Now, we've heard from Dr. Greg Jacobs a lot of skepticism about sleeping pills. Do you share that, or put this in perspective for us? How do you come down on this this epidemic of insomnia, and how sleeping pills help us?
Well, Anthony, I think the main thing is that one size does not fit all in terms of treatment for just about any condition. And I think that insomnia is one of those conditions. I certainly agree with Dr. Jacobs that many people benefit from non-pharmacologic treatment for their insomnia, from cognitive behavior therapy, from behavior therapy. However, there are some individuals for whom those treatments are either unavailable or ineffective, and in some of those cases, sleeping pills may be a very reasonable form of treatment for them.
Can we talk about sort of the ideal situation where if I'm a patient and I come to you and you say, this is a good, you know, you're a good candidate for sleeping pills. What's the patient that is a good candidate for sleeping pills? I mean, what's the condition?
Well, the patients that I tend to see, and I think that this is kind of emblematic of the good candidate for pharmacotherapy, that patient is someone who's had insomnia for a long time. The insomnia occurs just about every night, and it is associated with some impairment in terms of functioning during the daytime. So we know that people with insomnia really complain often very severely of difficulty concentrating, of mood disturbance. We know that they are at increased risk for developing mood disorders. So someone who really has daytime consequences may be a candidate for medication. Now, I'd also like to say that in virtually no case would I ever recommend a sleeping pill as the only treatment for insomnia. I think that in almost every case, a person can engage in behaviors that will improve their sleep, and that in combination with medication for the chronic insomnia sufferer may be a good strategy.
Mm. Let me bring Dr. Jacobs back into this, the sleeping pill skeptic. Is that fair? I mean, do you accept more or less that balance that Dr. Bicey suggested?
Well, I'm not sure if Dr. Bicey is suggesting a balance. I agree with his points. What he is suggesting is that there are patients who are either don't respond to cognitive behavioral therapy, and we believe that's about 25% of patients, and there are patients, at least up to this point in time, that have not had access or availability of cognitive behavioral therapy. So in those situations, physicians, particularly primary care physicians, have had no choice but to put patients on sleeping pills. Mm-hmm. The point I'm making is that that's going to change very quickly. First of all, cognitive behavioral therapy is going to be made widely available on the internet, as I've already pointed out.
You know, I guess I should stop you only because you've made reference to cognitive behavioral therapy, and I've been remiss in not getting you to explain what that is. So let's do that.
Sure.
I think we all know what sleeping pills are, but tell us about CBT.
Sure. CBT is based on a very simple premise that chronic insomnia in the majority of cases has a strong learn component. And if you can unlearn the behaviors that have led to insomnia, you can, in many cases, overcome insomnia. And those behaviors are actually fairly straightforward. They focus on things like worrying about not sleeping, which is a worry that has been compounded by the pharmaceutical companies and by the media in the last couple of years. People believe that you need to sleep 8 hours a night. If you don't, you're going to die sooner. So the worry about insomnia becomes a central focus of insomnia. Cognitive behavioral therapy teaches people to recognize, challenge, and change these negative distorted sleep cognitions. But cognitive behavioral therapy also does something that drugs don't. It teaches insomnia patients how to enhance their sleep drive. And they do that by actually, for example, restricting their time in bed to more closely match their actual sleep time, where insomnia patients do the opposite. They spend more and more time in bed. They become more and more awake, and their sleep is more fragmented, and the bed becomes a cue for wakefulness rather than sleep. We get patients to establish a more consistent arising time, to learn to associate the bed with sleep and not frustrating wakefulness, to learn basic relaxation skills and some lifestyle practices that improve sleep. If you can make that treatment available to patients, either by a therapist, by a book, or on the internet, then we know that the majority of patients derive significant benefit. In fact, clinically significant benefit that exceeds the clinical significance of sleeping pills.
Hmm. Let's take a call. Julie is calling from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Hi, Julie.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. What's on your mind?
Well, I've suffered from depression and anxiety disorders and also sleep problems. I do take sleep medication to help me sleep at night. And my point was that without the sleep medication, I wouldn't be able to deal with the depression and anxiety that are, you know, you mentioned them as, you know, possibly underlying causes at the top of the show. If you're not getting enough sleep, that enormously exacerbates those other problems.
Mm-hmm. Julie, stay on the line. Dr. Bicey, does Julie sound like a good candidate for sleeping medication?
Well, I wouldn't hazard a guess in her particular case, but she does mention a scenario that's one that we see very commonly in people who present with chronic insomnia. That is, they have at the same time problems with depression or anxiety. And we do know that severe insomnia can worsen those other conditions. There's actually a fair amount of evidence that insomnia may be a precursor to those problems. And there's now some emerging evidence using both behavioral treatments as well as medication treatments that treating the insomnia component of depression and anxiety may actually improve the outcomes of the depression and anxiety. So, you know, with the caveat that, as Dr. Jacobs mentioned, behavioral approaches also need to be attended to, with that caveat, people like Julie may be very good candidates for sleeping pills in addition to their other treatment.
Mm. Julie, thanks for the call. Dr. Bicey and also Dr. Jacobs, but let me start with you, Dr. Bicey. I'm curious to know how these so-called Z drugs work. Can you give us a non-wonkish explanation that sort of describes what they do to the brain in a way that the layman like me can understand?
Well, I'll let you be the judge of the wonkishness, but basically the Z drugs act in a way that's very similar to some of the sleeping pills that have been around for a longer amount of time. Drugs like triazolam and temazepam, those older drugs are known as benzodiazepine drugs. Mm-hmm. And basically what the new Z drugs do and what the benzodiazepine drugs do is that they augment the activity of one of the neurotransmitters in your brain that's called GABA. And GABA is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. That is, it tends to take things offline. So when you augment that activity, you essentially help to bring about relaxation and sleep.
Interesting. Now, Greg Jacobs, you talked about troubling side effects from some of these drugs. Can you explain what's going on there? Is that understood medically or biologically, what's going on with these side effects?
Well, I think, as Dr. Bicey would concur, any time that you produce changes in neurotransmitters in the brain by increasing GABA concentrations, for example, GABA is an inhibitory neurotransmitter, you are likely to induce unwanted side effects. And some of those side effects are minimized in the new Z drugs. The older benzodiazepines had a variety of side effects that were oftentimes worse than the desired effect. They disturbed your deep sleep. They disturbed your dream sleep. You had a hangover effect the next day. You could become dependent upon the drugs. The new Z drugs actually work more specifically in the brain, so they minimize many of the side effects, but they still have problematic side effects for a subset of patients, and those side effects include, for example, next-day cognitive impairment. When you produce changes in sleep, those drugs, in order to keep you asleep at night, are still having some residual effect in the morning, and some people are more affected by those than others, but on average, studies clearly show that even Ambien and Lunesta produce some impairment in cognitive and intellectual performance the next day. They also produce, as I said earlier, amnesia at night. We've heard a lot about this with Ambien, and some people get really frightened by what they get up and do in the middle of the night and don't remember the next day. But I think the bigger issue for most people is not so much these side effects, but the more potential problematic effect of becoming psychologically or possibly physically dependent upon these medications. The average person who takes a sleeping pill takes that sleeping pill for 2 years, and a third of people who take sleeping pills take them for 5 years or longer. That means that it becomes very difficult for people to get off of these medications, in part because the medications do not produce enduring improvements in sleep. Mm-hmm. So you may get some benefit while you're taking it, but as soon as you stop taking it, the insomnia comes right back. And if the drug does not produce some improvement long-term in sleep that persists when you stop the drug, they're not worth that much.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Ted, is calling from Haverhill, Massachusetts. Hi, Ted.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, I just kind of interested in your conversation because I think that what Dr. Jacobs is saying is quite a bit true. I'd be a strong candidate for having sleep problems because I work nights. And I sleep during the day most times, and I frequently adjust my sleep during the different times of the day. But I haven't had to resort to any medications because I've been really disciplined about establishing a good environment and just in a good practice of being able to sleep when I need to.
How do you do that? How do you do that, Ted? I mean, can you talk about some of the specifics that you do to actually get to sleep in off hours like that?
Right. I have blackout curtains in my rooms so that it remains, you know, not dark, but, you know, just kind of shady. And then at the same time, I've got clocks and things that I can use to set up some ambient noise, like the waves or a wind-type sound that kind of washes out any other sounds that might be coming in from the street during the day. And, you know, it's a practice you have to get into. And then contrary to a lot of my counterparts who have difficulty staying up at night, occasionally drift off to sleep during our shift, you know, I just fight and force myself to stay awake at night.
Mm-hmm.
Then that way, when it's time for me to sleep, I'm tired and I'm ready to sleep.
Interesting. Now, did you say that some of your colleagues use sleeping pills who work these off hours?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
A lot of them use sleeping pills, and they'll frequently come to work saying, you know, I'm just in awful shape because I can only sleep 3 or 4 hours today.
Okay.
And then they have difficulty working at night.
All right, Ted, thanks for the call. Dr. Bicey, let me ask you to respond to Ted. He makes a pretty strong case that better to go the natural route than the sleeping pill route, especially for people who work off hours. And that seems to be sort of, right, you know, an interesting point to bring up because so many of us are working hard in long hours and off hours.
I think that Ted brings up several really good points. The fact is that human beings are not biologically wired to sleep during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about insomnia in part as being a lifestyle problem, but it's one that we bring on ourselves. So if you want to be able to go to the grocery store at 12 o'clock midnight, that means that someone has to disrupt their sleep in order to allow you that privilege. So people are not biologically tuned to sleeping during the day. Ted actually adjusts better than many people do because the fact is that many individuals just are not able to sleep when their biological rhythms are telling them to be awake, that is, during the day. And in that situation, that can be an appropriate time for using medication. And I think that that's also a time that having set up his environment and his behaviors to maximize sleep, there are going to be many individuals for whom that is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's an example of one situation where cognitive behavior therapies, I think, can be somewhat limited when people are trying to sleep at a time that is just out of sync with their biological clock.
Well, let me ask Dr. Jacobs about that. Cognitive behavioral therapy, talk about it. I mean, is it limited in terms in that situation, in Ted's situation, where you need to get sleep in off hours where your natural clock is telling you to be awake?
Yes, it is limited because what Ted has would not just be classified as insomnia, but disruptions in his circadian rhythm. And circadian rhythm problems, which is a mismatch between your sleep schedule and the natural tendencies of the brain to want to sleep at night and be awake during the day, is oftentimes treated not just with behavioral techniques, but light therapy. And so exposure to a light box at certain times of the day is necessary to actually synchronize that circadian rhythm. So in CBT, is designed for more typical insomnia. I have problems falling asleep at night, or I wake up in the middle of the night, can't get back to sleep, and it's affecting me during the day. If you have sleep problems due to shift work, then you're getting into another group of sleep disorders where behavioral methods alone are not likely to be completely effective.
Mm. So you'd say okay in that situation to be prescribed a sleeping pill?
It may be okay if that individual doesn't first benefit from behavioral therapy and light therapy. And if that individual doesn't respond and a sleeping pill might be appropriate, then you look at how do you prescribe that pill. Too many physicians prescribe a sleeping pill on a nightly basis, even though the patient doesn't have nightly insomnia. Mm-hmm. People might sleep poorly three or four nights a week. Prescribing a pill every night gets people into long-term habitual patterns of use of a sleeping pill, and that may not be necessary. Recent reviews, for example, in New England Journal of Medicine have been very clear. If you're going to prescribe a sleeping pill, it should be for patients who have persistent insomnia and severe insomnia that do not respond well to cognitive behavioral therapy or don't have access to it. And if you're going to prescribe a pill, the lowest possible dose intermittently and assess the efficacy of that pill over time. And in many cases, after a month or two of use, people aren't sleeping that well on the pills anyway. Mm-hmm. There's no point in continuing to maintain that medication.
And we're going to bring one more voice into this conversation. Joining me now from Boston, Massachusetts is Juliet Shore. She's a professor of sociology at Boston College and the author of many books, including The Overworked American, The Unexpected Decline of Leisure, and her most recent book, Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture. And Professor Shore, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to this conversation, and the reason why we wanted to bring you in is just to get your take. I've heard you talk a lot, especially about your book, The Overworked American. Do you see this huge reliance on sleeping pills by many people as part of that culture of the overworked American?
Well, I'm not a medical doctor, and I haven't
done. And you don't play one on TV.
Right? Research on this particular topic, but I certainly, when you think about these trends in sleeping pill use, one is led to think about the way people are living their lives today and the kinds of changes that have happened that may be a part of this. For example, the fact that we have many people working much longer hours, the fraction of work which is spilling over into the evening and weekends, what had prior earlier been more leisurely time. Are people working, until 10 o'clock at night and then having to quickly shift gears to go to bed? And have they lost that period of wind down that might have been important in relaxing them at the end of the day? So that the increased busyness of daily life, both in terms of higher job demands, we also know people are working more intensively while they're on the job. The stress levels on the job are higher. So is that contributing to more difficulty sleeping naturally?
I'd love to get responses from both our doctor guests on that, Juliet Shore. Dr. Bicey, first to you. I mean, how do you see the sort of the stepped up pace of our frenetic modern existence as contributing to this?
Well, to be honest, I just don't think that there's really any good evidence that the prevalence of insomnia is actually increasing. Hmm. When you ask people if they have trouble falling or staying asleep, you get answers generally in the range of about a third of the population, and a much smaller fraction, 5 to 10%, have persistent problems with insomnia that are associated with daytime impairment. And again, I'm not really aware that there's good evidence that that has changed much over time. Hmm. What has changed a lot over time is the amount of sleep that people get. And what it may sound like the same thing, but it's not. And it goes back to a point that Dr. Jacobs made before, which is that sleep deprivation is not the same thing as insomnia. Mm-hmm. So our long work hours, I think, pose two dangers. One is that we could be so worried about work that we can't sleep even when we have the opportunity. That's insomnia. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we could be working two or three jobs so that we only have 3 hours left for sleep in the day. That's sleep deprivation. And they cause actually different consequences. And only one of those groups is the group that is liable to benefit from either cognitive behavior therapy or sleeping pills.
Because I have a suspicion about this, and I'm going to bring in, sort of refer to my own experience with this. I've, on a very limited basis, have taken sleeping pills. And here's when I've done it, and I'd love to get both of your response. And I think it has to do with more an issue of sleep deprivation than insomnia. And that is, you get home. As Juliet Shore said, you have very little wind-down time. You look at the clock and you realize, if I go to sleep now, I have 5.5 hours to sleep, and I have to be up and operating by 7 in the morning. You know, I have to in some cases. So at that point, take an Ambien, boom, you go to sleep, and you maximize that 5 hours of sleep, as opposed to hitting the pillow and going, oh, my God, I'm still awake, and now if I don't get to sleep, I've got only four and a half hours of sleep. And, oh, my God, I'm still awake, and I've only got 4 hours of sleep. Good use of sleeping pills, bad use of sleeping pills. I'd love to know. Let me start with Greg Jacobs.
Well, good use of sleeping pills or bad use of sleeping pills. If you have insomnia, taking a sleeping pill, again, can be appropriate, particularly in the early stages of insomnia.
Right. But in the particular case that I just laid out, I don't have insomnia. I'm just worried about not having enough quality sleep.
Well, in your case, Anthony, if you had 5 hours to sleep and you found over a period of a week or two that, in fact, you couldn't fall asleep and you weren't getting enough sleep and you were having impaired daytime functioning, then you may be a candidate for a sleeping pill, at least short term. If you fall asleep easily and you only have 5 hours to sleep, then insomnia is not the problem. The problem is your lifestyle and your inability to allot an adequate amount of time for sleep at night, and that becomes a lifestyle issue, not an insomnia issue.
Mm. Yeah, go ahead, Julia. Sure.
Jump in here.
Yes, please do.
Is that I think, my view of it is that what's happened is that the constraints on people's ability to choose their lifestyles have really tightened, and so if jobs are more demanding, if family life expectations and pressures require more running around and extracurriculars for the kids and all of those sorts of things. We can refer to it as lifestyle, but that suggests there's so much choice. And I think what many, many households are finding is they don't it's very difficult for them to arrange their lives in such a way that they can get enough sleep and get the wind down time and so forth. And there are structural problems here. On top of this, of course, are the stresses associated with work and income and survival in this country. And so you've got much higher levels of financial stress when mm-hmm. you have so many people living paycheck to paycheck, rising rates of bankruptcy, the big increases in consumer debt, and so forth.
Sure.
And I wonder how those play into people's sleep patterns.
Mm. Juliet Shore, great points. I'm really delighted that you joined us today. And I want to say goodbye to you and thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Juliet Shore is professor of sociology at Boston College. Her latest book is Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture. She's also author of The Overworked American, The Unexpected Decline of Leisure. Let's try to go to some calls. Andy is calling from Harvard, Massachusetts. Hi, Andy.
Hi, how you doing? Good morning. Great show.
Thanks.
I've struggled with, I guess it's insomnia, for about 5 or 6 years, and my wife has always encouraged me to go to the doctor. I run my own company. I've got two toddlers. I've got a fair amount on my mind, and I did go to the doctor about 2 years ago, And he prescribed Celexa, and I went home and looked it up on the internet and read enough about Celexa to not fulfill the subscription. And until I heard this show this morning, I've actually, over the past couple of years, I've stopped thinking about it. You know, I pretty much survive on 5, maybe 6 hours of sleep a night. And my question is not so much about the drugs, which I've, for the moment, decided not to take, but is it possible that some people can function on 5 or 6 hours of sleep? I mean, it started off as worrying about things, but now it's just become what I do. You know, I get up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and start my day.
Doctors, Dr. Bicey, how much sleep do we need? Is it the same for everybody?
It's certainly not the same for everybody. Although it's very clear that when people in general get less than about 5 hours of sleep, their performance during the daytime starts to suffer. So there are some limits beyond which the majority of people will suffer. I think that in issues of sleep deprivation, it's just not the case that people ever really get used to having inadequate amounts of sleep. In Andy's case, if really the thing preventing him from getting more sleep is just an inability to sleep more, even given the opportunity, then that is an insomnia problem. I would like to make the point, too, that the medication that he was prescribed, Celexa, is an antidepressant, an anti-anxiety drug. It's not a sleeping pill. And it brings up actually a very important point, which is that many physicians, because of the fears that they have, rightly or wrongly, about sleeping pills, many of them prescribe other medications for sleep that are largely untested, that have other side effects that we should be concerned about, and that are not necessarily safer alternatives to the drugs that have been actually assessed for treating insomnia.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Michael is calling from Chelsea, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael.
Yes, hello. It's a wonderful show, and thank you so much for doing this topic.
Thank you.
I've suffered from depression and sleep disorders and have chosen not to take drugs. I feel that our society has become an inactive people who want to be spoon-fed, who want the quick-fix magic pill. I think people should be prescribed daily aerobic exercise for an overall well-being. You know, that includes sleep disorders, depression, obesity, and get back to the basics and stop supporting these ridiculous drug companies who are making way too much money off this whole.
Michael, I hear your point, but did you stop taking the pills because they were having a bad effect on you, or was this more a philosophical objection that you developed?
It was more of a philosophical objection that I just decided I didn't want to go this route, and I don't like the way our country's headed with everyone just popping pills for every little problem that they come up with.
Right. So how's it been working? I mean, does exercise help you sleep?
Most definitely. You know, when I'm on a regimen of exercise, I definitely sleep through the night, and I know that if I stop that for whatever reason, whether it's due to a busy schedule or any other excuses that I come up with, that definitely my sleep is affected from this.
Well, thanks for the call, Michael. Dr. Jacobs, what about exercise as part of the sort of non-medical pharmaceutical response to sleeplessness? How important
is that? That's something that's recommended for insomnia patients. The evidence is probably more limited that exercise by itself would have a significant effect on insomnia. Exercise is more likely to have effect on somebody who's depressed. And if they exercise and their depression lifts, then their sleep will oftentimes improve. But I think Andy raised a very good point. He chose not to take sleeping pills or medications. Ultimately, the majority of patients who take sleeping pills decide not to take them for a very good reason or continue to take them. They don't work that well. This is the major issue that we haven't addressed yet. It's not so much the side effects, it's the efficacy of these medications. I can tell you that a very consistent rule that I see in my clinical practice is about a third of patients who take sleeping pills do pretty well with them. About a third of patients derive inconsistent effects. They work on some nights, they don't work on other nights, and at least a third will take one pill or another pill or multiple pills and they have no effect. So over time, people learn these pills don't work that well. In the British Medical Journal published a major study 2 months ago showing that in adults age 60 and up, which are the biggest users of sleeping pills have small and marginal effects that are oftentimes outweighed by a significant and consistent increase in side effects. So the biggest issue here is many of these pills don't even work that well. You still have insomnia when you take them. You still take a long time to fall asleep and stay asleep.
Yeah, I hear Dr. Bicey wanting to get in on this. I'd love to get your response.
And I would disagree here because the evidence is when studies have been compared head-to-head using rigorous methods that cognitive behavior treatments and other non-pharmacologic interventions for insomnia have just the same magnitude of effect as sleeping pills do. This is the only good studies have been short-term studies. I think that something we haven't talked about yet is that there actually is evidence now from published research, and it's research supported by drug companies, but it's research that shows the assumption that people quickly get tolerant to the effects of sleeping pills does not occur in rigorously controlled clinical trials of 6 months' duration. So I think that to just say as a matter of fact that people get tolerant to these medications and they don't work, I think is not in keeping with the evidence that's been published in the scientific literature.
Okay, well, we put the argument out there. I don't think we're going to resolve this argument today in this moment, and I want to give time for our callers because we've still got a lot of people waiting online. One on the line, 800-423-8255 is the number to call. Jean is calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Jean.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I wanted to know, I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia a number of years ago, and I have a terrible time sleeping, but I do yoga. I do do cardiovascular exercise, but I've recently been put on something called trazodone. I don't like taking it because I have four children, two of whom are very small, mm-hmm. and I'm up and down with them all night. They're not great sleepers, and some of the times I get up with them and I don't remember it. My husband will tell me the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything I can do? I don't have any anxiety disorder. I don't have depression. Is there something else I can do that to take care of this? Because I really don't like the idea of taking the medication. I don't get into bed until I'm tired, and when I'm tired, I'm exhausted because of the fibromyalgia. But I will get in bed, and regardless of how tired my body is, I can't fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
So then I get up and I take the trazodone, and then the next day I feel just not quite on top of things.
Well, let's throw this out to the two doctors here. My guess is you're going to get two different suggestions. Dr. Bicey.
Trazodone is one of the medications that physicians often prescribe because of their fears of the so-called sleeping pills. Trazodone was originally marketed as an antidepressant. It has never formally been assessed for the treatment of insomnia, and as Jean finds, it does clearly have side effects. So the concern is that because trazodone is not a scheduled substance, physicians are willing to prescribe it, yet it can have side effects mm-hmm. that are worse than the FDA-approved sleeping pills.
We have very little time left, Dr. Jacobs. I want to give the last word to you, a final word of advice to Jean, who I thank for her call.
My final word of advice to Jean. Jean sounds like she doesn't have just insomnia. She said she also has been diagnosed with fibromyalgia. That indicates that this is a little bit more of a complex problem. Medications may provide benefit to her, but as she's saying, they may have detrimental effects on daytime functioning. She would be serve herself well to investigate behavioral approaches because mm-hmm. she may be able to minimize her medication use and derive more improvement. And contrary to what Dr. Bicey indicated, cognitive behavioral therapy has been shown to be more effective than sleeping pills in the long term.
Okay.
In direct comparisons,
right.
It's more effective for sleep onset insomnia. So
right.
We disagree on the efficacy of the two approaches.
I understand there's definitely a disagreement here, but it's great to get both points of view out there.